Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. And of course, whenever Phil's here, we talk about the world of insects. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Phil, nice to have you back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
You have heard, or maybe you have the sighting yourself. I don't think you had this sighting yourself, but there was.
Well, I saw pictures.
Saw some pictures of an interesting insect.
Well, you know, this is the time of the year you kind of sit back and look what was going on during the growing season, and we had a state record for a hawk moth called a gaudy sphinx. And it really is a stunning animal. It has a wingspan of about 3 inches, is a deep green forewing, and then these bright blue eye spots. And it was caught up in Door County on a beach. And somebody had taken a digital image of it, and Janice Stiefel, who is a member of the Wisconsin Entomological Society up there, had sent the picture down. And she already is pretty sure what it was, but
yeah.
As we check the records, it's the first time it's ever been seen in Wisconsin. And it's interesting because Door County gets a lot of this. I mean, if you look at the records, and I don't know if it is airflow patterns or what, but we do see a lot of these. This is a tropical insect. It is found
in Florida.
Yeah, northern Florida probably is the farthest north it can breed, and even there it's kind of sparse. So it's more associated with Central America and places like that. So this was a real treat, and as I said, it was in this day of digital images, it's kind of fun because I'm not so sure this would have gotten picked up, you know, without somebody getting some pictures and then sending it out to see what they had. So that was a real treat.
Real treat. Well, Tom in Manitowoc has a question for you, so let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I'm in the process of cutting deer here, Larry, and there's a lot of wood ticks on the neck. And I was wondering, Phil, I'm always fascinated by these lowly ticks, but do they hang on that carcass all winter long, or do they drop off, and do they take the blood for their own nourishment, or is that to enhance their eggs for next year?
Well, the first thing is there's a chance that you've got a rather odd tick that we call a winter tick. The way ticks work is normally they would only feed for 4 or 5 days on their host and then drop off. But what makes the winter tick unique is once it gets on the animal, it stays and completes its whole life cycle. So it would be a tick that would stay there for months and feed and molt its skin. And when I see lots of ticks associated in the neck of an animal, I get suspicious that they're winter ticks. Now, the other tick that's out there right now is the deer tick. And the deer tick would be one example of one that just feeds for a few days and drops off. Although they use it for their own nourishment, the very large grayish female ticks that you find often falling off your dog or the like, these things swell almost like a balloon. And what they are utilizing the blood for, the protein, is to produce eggs. And the female will lay upwards of 2,000 or 3,000 eggs, and in that process, it kills her. So she really only mates once. So it's a very fascinating process. And so, as I said, I would have to see the ticks to be sure which, but if it was just large numbers of ticks clustered on the neck, I would suspect it may be this winter tick, which is a very close relative of what we call the wood tick. The wood tick is one of this feed and fall off, feed and fall off. And all the ticks that we have in this state only really feed 3 times during their life cycle, and their life cycle typically takes 2 years.
Interesting.
And then when they drop off, are they able to move? I mean, when you look at them, they're so big and bulbous. you wonder how they can even crawl down into the ground to.
Yeah. No, I think they just get down the leaf litter as best they can. And in this case, you know, we're late enough in the season that they're not going to be able to produce those eggs until next spring. So it's kind of like they go dormant. And then next spring, they kind of wake up again. And they're really quite resilient. I mean, we can get 20 below and they seem to be able to, I mean, they don't have to get very far in the leaf litter to be well protected.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks for calling. Bob in Door County, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
I have a flea problem in my house. Can you give me any idea how I can get rid of them?
Do you have pets?
Yes.
Okay, dogs or cats?
A dog.
Okay, then it'll be a little easier. It's the same tick, flea, that's on both dogs and cats, but the animal's behavior, the pet's behavior, has a lot to do with where they breed. What has been on the market now for about 15 years is an insect hormone that is sold in many of the sprays and bombs. And what the hormone will do is prevent the eggs from hatching and the larvae from developing. And it is less toxic than many of the standard insecticides. Although I will tell you, the hormone doesn't affect the adults. So most of the sprays you buy are a combination of insecticide to knock the adults down and this insect growth regulator or hormone for long-term control. But the secret is twofold. You're going to have to do something with the animal, and whether you get some of these front lines or other on-animal products or use one of the shampoos and deal with the fleas that are there. But the breeding is going on where your dog spends a lot of time resting. And what goes on is when the adult fleas are feeding, they defecate large amounts of processed blood. And that's what the immature, almost maggot-like stage of the flea feeds on. So this accumulates in the dog bedding area, or if the dog spends a lot of time on the couch, it could be there. A lot of times it's in you know, the living room rug. And here's the difference with cats. You know, cats with their behavior are spending time back in a closet or under a bed. So that's where the breeding's going on, in a very out-of-the-way place. And so I find that people set a bomb off in their living room and think they'll solve the problem. And if they've got cats, they don't.
That isn't going to happen.
They're not, you know, really hunting down the source. So I find that the homeowner is probably the best understander of where your animal spends time and where these hot spots are. So you treat the animal, you know, treat these hot spots, and then the other thing to do is vacuum on a daily basis. That will remove the adult fleas that are present and give you a quicker relief. So you can buy these things at pet stores, and in a lot of times even hardware stores that have insecticides will have flea control products available. And as I said, part of it is, you know, read the directions, but really what you've got to think about is, where does my animal spend a lot of time? Because those are the sites I want to make sure to get treated. Mm-hmm. And the problem with bombs is they don't penetrate very well. And so if your cat spends time under a couch, you have to move the couch and treat the carpet underneath it. You can't expect the bomb to penetrate through the couch.
Good luck.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for calling. Jim in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've had a strange insect move in this fall that I'd like identified. It's deep gray or dull black with a orangish or reddish V on the back where the wings come together. A little over half an inch long, lozenge-shaped with spindly legs and antenna. Very slow-moving, likes to get on my south windows. And sometimes its compatriots seem to be on the other side of the window on the outside.
Sounds like a box elder bug to me.
Okay, why do they come inside, and should I do anything about them?
Well, the good news is they're harmless. They don't breed, but this is their behavior, is to spend the winter rent-free. And in particular, I think in the northern part of the state that has stayed dry all year long, box elder bugs do well when it's dry, because their normal controlling factor is a fungus disease that needs moisture. Now, in the southern part of the state, although we've seen some, their numbers really got reduced with those heavy rainfalls that came through in just the right time in August and September. So the one thing, I mean, you can kill them with a spray of soapy water. You can vacuum them up. But I wouldn't worry too much. I mean, other than the nuisance of having them around, and what you will experience now is, even in January, on a nice sunny day, a couple will wake up and just kind of slowly move through the house. If you were going to stop them, really you dry the lawn or put the line in the sand in September, because that's when they're moving in, and either you have to stop them on the outside of the house or caulk things and prevent that. Now the fear is that they're already up under the siding or in the attic and the wall voids, and so whatever you do isn't going to be effective in the long run, other than to deal with the individual ones that are out in the open.
Okay. Thank
All right.
you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling, Jim. And let's turn to Dave in Hayward. Dave, hello to you.
Good morning, Larry. Hello, Phil. I'm your former DHL driver in Madison, if you remember me at all.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'm now up northern Wisconsin. I've got a question for you. It's a spider, and it's usually in one of my pastures. It makes a circular web, and it's yellow and black, and it stays right in the middle of the web at all times of the day. Do you have any idea what that might be?
Yeah, the family we call orbweb or orb weaver spiders, and this one is sometimes called the black and yellow garden spider. The genus is Argiop, or some people call it Argiop. It's a very common late summer spider, totally harmless. In fact, there's three species that you could run into, but they're all that same form of bright yellow and black banding on the bodies. And what you see are the large females. And what they will do is lay an egg sac, and that's how this particular spider gets through the winter.
Interesting.
Okay.
All right.
Great. All right. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yep. Good talking to you.
Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving to you as well, Dave. Carol in DeForest. Hi to you.
Good morning. I have a Morris recliner that was stored in a house that was built in the 1860s that's only occasionally used during the summer. And I brought the chair down here to use, and something is working on the legs. There are it's sawdust at the bottom, and you can see almost like wormholes coming out of the bottom, three inches.
With wood that's that old, the only critter that, well, I won't say only, but the most likely source is something we call a powder post beetle. Now, is the sawdust that comes out very fine like talcum powder, or is it coarser than that?
Okay. Very fine.
Yeah.
In one of the reasons that piece of furniture was attacked really is it was in a building that was basically unheated. This is an animal that is found in very well seasoned firewood. It's found in barn board and other unpainted surfaces typically. But it needs a certain moisture and starch content to be successful. And what happens is normally in our homes, we dry our wood out so much during the winter, whether we use wood burners or standard heating. But in a home that's not utilized that much, the moisture levels stay up. Boy, this is going to be a bit of a stinker. Is it possible to screw the legs off in any form?
No, it isn't.
Okay.
It goes right up into the back of the chair.
Okay. What my fear is that this insect can continue to cycle through to the point that it will structurally ruin the wood. And you can't kill it well with insecticides because they don't penetrate the surface. Now, you know, in larger objects, sometimes they fumigate. In certain circumstances, on smaller objects, we can try to freeze them to death. Going from a nice warm room to a very cold environment in a short period of time. There's some boric acid treatments that can be used, but the wood has to be stripped so that the borates diffuse in. And I don't find any of those to be really very suitable for the legs of the piece of furniture, unfortunately.
No. Have you got an outside building that's unheated?
Yes, we do.
Well,
I'm storing it out in the garage right now because I didn't want to bring it into the house.
Well, what will happen now? Now you've got some time to make a choice here because the coolness of the garage, the insects are not going to be active until next April or May. So you're kind of putting them on hold. You may consider, I think it's worth a try that if you go and buy almost any of the standard ant and roach sprays and just spray them on the legs and see what happens. Again, the limitation is that these things don't penetrate and these insects can be deeper, but they do eventually have to come out to the surface. And so you may be able to drastically knock down their numbers. My only concern in your house would be if you had a lot of rustic, beams, any surface that you've got is painted or sealed in any form, plus the dryness of it will not be suitable. So I'm not too concerned about this infestation spreading. Be a little concerned on the flooring, if you're on oak flooring, that the little buggers can try to get in there. I don't think they'll be very successful because of the finish and the like, but that would be a little concern. So as I said, for now, the consideration, they will not freeze out because you're allowing them to prepare for the winter. The way freezing works is to take them when they're active and working at 70 degrees and happy and slamming the door with a very cold temperature. And I'm not talking 32 degrees. I'm talking zero. You know, and so that's a little harder to predict. But in the garage, where we are now, is they will be inactive till next spring. So you can kind of give it some time to see what's up.
Mm-hmm.
The worst case scenario, I guess, is that you'll probably have to have somebody help you out and put new legs on the piece.
Yeah. Good luck.
So it wouldn't help to put it in a plastic bag to fumigate it or something of that sort?
Well, you've got a true fumigant is a toxic gas that is not available to homeowners. So you would have to have this commercially done.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not a cheap process because the company usually has to bring in some kind of trailer or chamber to put the article in that is airtight. Then they pump it full of the toxic gas, and that would kill pieces. So for very valuable pieces, it is an option. This is what they do at times in museums on very valuable antiques. But for the average person, you know...
Hundreds of dollars.
Hundreds of dollars, yeah.
Okay. And then with the house that it came out of, what should I think about in terms of that?
Well, there you may have some options. I would check the flooring. Again, it depends, I think, on the status of a lot of the wood. If you were to have trouble, I see this quite commonly in new flooring that comes infested with powder post beetles. And what they do there is if they strip the floor so that we're down to bare wood again, and then they use a borate treatment like Timbor or Octobor, and then retreat the thing. And what borates do is they soak into the wood when it's untreated, and then when the powder post beetles come up to the surface, they feed on it and die. And so it's a way of treating something like that. So there are some treatments that would be available depending what you have that's infested. But again, what I think you're going to expect to find is that anything that is in any kind of painting or varnish type of shape will not be affected. It's only that rustic type stuff like barn board and rustic beams that we get hit, or what we call farm sawed lumber sometimes.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Carol. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Give us a call if you have a question at 800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And let's go to Rosemary in Madison next. Rosemary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you both. Phil, I wonder if you could settle a mystery for me. We have mosquitoes inside the house now.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that, you know, we don't have any standing water that we can find anywhere. What's happening?
Well, of the 54 mosquito species we have, there are a handful that overwinter as adults. And typically they would do this in caves. We quite commonly see them in basements. And I think that's what you've seen is some of these adult mosquitoes try to migrate in, although they are looking for a somewhat cool, shaded environment because they, again, are, it's not a true hibernation, but they're kind of going dormant. So you never expect this to have continually active mosquitoes. But as I said, I would be concerned that the little stinkers have kind of migrated in from the outside. Are you seeing them in...
This is a house that doesn't have a basement. It's a slab.
Okay.
So where in the world then could they be?
Well, no, they're still coming in from outside. It's just a question
that they're still coming in from outside.
Yeah, they're not going to do very well. And, well, okay. We can say that they have come in from outside. I think we're cold enough now that we're pretty much done with outside insect activity.
Okay.
And if it continues...
Yes.
Meaning you see three or four a day and it just doesn't seem to go away. I'd like you to send me one just to confirm that with the right kind of mosquito.
Okay.
Because then I don't know if I've ever seen in my career a situation where I would say, yes, mosquitoes. I have found mosquitoes breeding indoors. They're just, you know, the water, standing water has to be kind of polluted and gunky and has to sit for an extended period of time. We just normally don't see that.
Nothing like that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, will you give me your address so that I know where to send this thing?
The insect lab is at 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive.
Okay.
Madison, and the university zip is 53706.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Dan in Mesomania, I believe, is next. Let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan.
Hello. This is another powder post beetle question. We have a log cabin. It's made out of white pine and jack pine. It's in Jackson County, and it's just, you know, small log cabin. And every time I go up there in the summertime, if I'm not there for a couple of weeks, there'll be, you know, a handful size aggregations of the dust. You know,
but it's all real fine, or is it? It's somewhat coarser.
I think it's pretty fine.
See, the only thing I'm nervous about is the extent. If you talk handfuls, then I start thinking of carpenter ants. Instead,
I've seen a couple of carpenter ants, but I've tried to keep my eyes open and haven't seen too many. And I don't see any like ant parts or anything like that in the.
Well, look. You know, sometimes the true powder post beetle usually are small piles,
mm-hmm.
and it is the equivalent of talcum powder. It's extremely fine. There's no little chunks or anything. Whereas if there's anything of a bigger consistency, then it's got to be something different. And I assume this is an older cabin?
It was built in 86.
Okay. Is the wood finished or sealed in any form?
Well, the outside is was treated with some sort of preservative.
Mm-hmm.
It's not shiny, and then the inside has varnish.
Okay. And where exactly are the piles showing up?
There are very small holes, and any place where it can collect, you know, underneath those holes, like on a shelf or something,
mm-hmm.
so you can see where it comes right out of these very tiny holes, you know, at the most 32nd of an inch
okay.
in diameter.
Then it does. I mean, everything fits, round holes, size of holes, and whatnot. Now the problem, here again is that you've got things already sealed, and the borate treatments will not penetrate through that sealing. Mm-hmm. And so if that was the direction you were going to go, and really, I think in the long run is, then you somehow have to strip this so that you have basically bare wood that will allow the borates to go through.
Okay.
Now, if you don't want to go to that extent, again, then we fall back onto what I think is the second best of a choice, is to use an insecticide that has some residual. And so again, you know, whether you talk about the ortho bug be gones or the Bayer's home pest
control. I've tried that, you know, try and direct the spray into the holes as best as possible, as best I can, and I can't tell that that really helps.
Well, I mean, really what the theory with this treatment isn't so much that the holes that you're penetrating there, is that you put a residual insecticide on the surface, so when the little stinkers come out, they will come in contact with it. So it's really kind of a bleeding out process rather than a magic stop your, you know, snap your fingers and they're gone. And if I had to give you the proper time, I would do it in the spring because the biggest activity of the lichened powder post beetles is usually May. And so that's when I would want my product on. And I think I would only treat it once in the spring and just see where it goes from there. And again, I think you'll find that most of the materials, Ortho used to put out a product called OrthoChlor, which was made for killing termites and powder post beetles. We didn't see a lot of it sold up here because we don't have much in the way of termite problems. So that would be one thing to look for. But I'm really not that nervous about you using the bug be gones and whatnot for indoor use the same way, that if they're made for putting on a wood surface, it should have enough residual if you put it on in spring to help you bleed the numbers out. And again, if I just don't know any other way to get to them. And that's right. What the problem is that they're hiding, you know, they can be a couple inches deep in the wood and there's nothing in the world other than fumigation that takes care of that.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, you know, how long can this, you know, can the cabin survive? They're, you know, they're 14-inch diameter logs, something like that.
To be honest, real long. You know, what's hard to predict here is their success depends on the starch and moisture content of the wood, and that varies. And you will sometimes just see certain logs. I would be most nervous about the low logs. Anything that's got more moisture than the rest of the logs tend to be where they're happier. And so anything you can do to prevent moisture from accumulating, to keep things on the drier side, is to your benefit. Now, the one other thing that you'll see from the log home supply companies is that a lot of times it's a combination of a dry rot and the beetles themselves. So it's two things going on. And another way of putting on this borate treatment is they have a rod called Impel, I-M-P-E-L, and it's a borate rod. And for some of these lower logs that are rotting because of the moisture wicking and the beetles, they just drill a hole into it, insert the rod, and cap it. And then the borates slowly diffuse. But this is more of a spot problem. You know, you had a particular corner that was bad. That's what you'd use that treatment for. If you had this scattered throughout, it's not practical for that type of thing. But that's another way of trying to slow down particular problem spots and maybe more feasible. And as I said, I mean, ultimately, I tell people I'm probably more concerned about the moisture and the dry rots than I am the powder post beetles. I have seen homes that are 150 years old that are infested. And everything's still pretty sound. In fact, that's the big thing we get when people get into these old cabins, is there's signs of powder post beetle, but they're not active anymore. They have naturally died out because as wood ages, it loses its starch content, which means it becomes less suitable.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. Good luck to you. Appreciate your call. Laura in Solon Springs, your turn. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
And I had a bug hit, well, not a bug, an insect beetle, very huge, hit our window in early October. Now, we live on the lake shore, and it looks like a dragonfly larva, that kind of thing, but it was huge. It was like a size of a can lid, maybe 3 by 4 inches.
But it had wings.
It must have had wings. I mean, it stunned it, and it fell down on the roof, and we could see it from our window. But it hit the window, so it must have had wings.
Okay, well, there's two things I can think of that would come from aquatic environments. Mm-hmm. That there is a giant water bug, which looks very beetle-like, that is about 4 inches long. And typically, in the fall, they move from water sources to bigger water sources, like rivers and large lakes, to spend the winter. There's also some predaceous diving beetles, the Dytiscids and the Hydrophilids. There's two families of beetles. They don't get quite that big. I'd say 2.5 to 3 inches in size. And they also tend to move around a bit in the fall of the year looking for overwintering water sources. And so if you had lights on, both these insects are attracted to lights.
Yeah.
That would draw them into the window pane. But I'm leaning towards a giant water bug just because of the size you describe, and you're in the perfect environment to expect to see one.
Sure.
Yeah, well, water bugs are more oval. This was kind of, like I said, like a dragonfly nymph shape, and it had like little pincher, or not pincher,
okay.
but little...
Well, then the other thing is a Dobson fly, which is also found in aquatic environments, and they are very primitive looking and have huge wings on them, and the males have very pronounced jaws, and they would be 4 inches long, and they're very elongated. Although I tend to get more Dobson flies in the middle of the summer flying around, and the same thing attracted to light. But from your description, then it probably is a Dobson fly, because that would be closer. I just was leaning away from it because of the lateness of when you saw the critter.
Yeah, well, it's just the biggest thing I've ever seen, and I wondered what it was.
So yeah, but if you can get on the internet, just do an image search for a Dobson fly and see if that fits.
Okay, I will.
Thank you, Laura. Appreciate the call. Ron in Peshtigo, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Phil. So I will get spiders in our apartment. They're black and about the size of a large raisin, and they can move really fast, and they jump.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get rid of them, and there'll be three of them if I use one of these pest strips. The only thing is you're not supposed to use them in the home.
Right.
What would I use to get rid of them?
Well, a couple things. It is a jumping spider. There's a family of jumping spiders called salticids, and they are really often very brightly colored. A jet black with little white spots or little orange spots on the body is a very common species that we see. You'll often see them around windowsills and elsewhere, and you know, it's a spider that doesn't make a web. It doesn't really cause much of a problem.
That's right. I have never seen a web.
Right. No. And so, you know, it's one of these things that's kind of a personal choice. You know, you don't worry about them biting you or causing any problems there. I guess what would be the next option is to just use a little bit of an ant spray in the windowsills and maybe a couple corners where you've seen activity. I wouldn't spray a lot of area. But the whole idea there is these kind of sprays tend to last for a number of weeks, if not months. And so you would get the same effect as you get out of the no-pest strips, but you would not be exposing yourself to insecticide that is in the air you breathe.
How dangerous are these pest strips?
Well, you know, it's an organophosphate insecticide, so it's a nerve poison. And what they have done is restricted the use of these because the classic example is somebody who had a summer home would put a couple of these up to kill the flies and whatnot. And as you're gone, basically the level of this toxic gas builds up. And so you open the door and you walk in and your eyes are burning and your throat's burning and whatnot. Well, that's telling you your body's reacting to this stuff. And it's all, again, the fact that it is in the air. In order for this to be effective, it has to be in a closed environment.
They work great.
Yeah, they work great, but I would not, to be honest, put them in a place that I had to breathe them on a daily basis.
I see.
All right. Well,
thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Michelle in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. I'm afraid I don't have anything very exciting.
That's
but
all right.
It turns out it's costly, not exciting. I have brought clothes moths from Boston with me into my new house in Madison. We had all of the closets painted. So I was pretty sure that there was nothing here in Madison, and we brought moths in our sweaters.
Now, have you seen the clothes moths?
I have seen the holes and the little...
Casings?
The casings,
okay,
yes.
Good. I find I also have to worry about carpet beetles because they can cause sweater damage. And do you have oriental rugs?
Pardon me?
Do you have wool oriental rugs?
Yes.
Ouch.
we do. We've had clothes moth problems for a number of years, and we've tried pheromone traps and freezing the sweaters, and now I've sort of dry cleaned the whole closet. If I dry clean everything, put up the pheromone traps, is there any chance that the eggs could be on the walls of the closets or...
Somewhat small. I mean, the dry cleaning should kill everything there. What I'm suspicious of is that you may have a bit of a population working your rugs. And so you're not getting to all the sources. And, of course, then they keep flying over and reinfesting the sweaters.
Okay, the rug is, yeah, I don't have any rugs near those closets.
Oh, but the moths themselves are they're very interesting. They like things that are dark and out of the way, but still the adult females can fly all around. And so I would check any kind of silk, wall hangings, rugs, turn the rugs over, because if they're there, you're going to see the casings on the underside, not the top side.
Okay.
And look at that as the potential reinfesting source. The rugs get to be difficult because, you know, high value rugs, you don't really want to put insecticide on them.
Right.
But there are products that are in fact, there's some of the same kinds of chemicals that we put on our clothing as tick repellents that can be used. But again, from the history that you're telling me, I just don't think you're cleaning the infestation out. And I'm sure with what you're doing with the sweaters that you've solved that issue. I just think they keep cross-infesting, and I would look at other items that are responsible. And the pheromone traps are great to monitor.
Okay.
They by themselves will not eliminate the problem, because what you've got to keep in mind is all you're doing is collecting males.
Oh, they're not collecting the females.
Nope. They're only collecting the males. And so, you know, it gives you an idea of how successful your control is, because if the numbers are few and far between, then you know it's not much of a sight. But and if you catch nothing, that's even better news. But again, as far as utilizing that as a control strategy, I mean, hypothetically, if you caught all the males before they mate with a female, that would solve the problem. But it doesn't work that way.
No,
okay.
It doesn't.
And one last question. Does regular washing in cold or warm water do it, or does it have to be dry cleaning?
No, in fact, to be honest, even the temperature in the dryer, if the fabrics could take it, would kill it. Any insect you get above 112 degrees, you could kill.
Okay.
And freezing is an option, but in freezing, much like we talked about with some of these wood-infesting insects, you've got to have things warm and happy. You know, in normal room temperatures, and then you put them in a plastic garbage bag and put them in the freezer for 3 or 4 days. That itself should kill it, because it's the shock that's taking them out.
Yeah.
Now, the clothes moth that's living up in the attic that has cooled down naturally and whatnot already has prepared to get through the winter and can survive even 20 below because it's been acclimated. It's prepared. And so, as I said, anytime we use temperature regimes, it's more the shock that you're going after.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Traps were mentioned there. And is there some sort of trap? We've got an email here. Some sort of trap that can attract and trap adult European sawflies from pine trees. This is in the Chilton area.
Mm-hmm. No. I don't know of any ones that have been developed. People have played around a bit with the pheromones of sawflies. They've been identified. But the same problem is, in general, what these traps utilize is the chemicals that the females use to attract the males. And so the same thing would happen. We could collect a lot of males, but the females that are not attracted to the trap are still basically the reproducing members of the population. So generally, these traps have been used as a monitoring device. And again, even for monitoring, the one thing about European pine sawfly, it is so predictable. It's one of the most constant insect problems that we have. I can guarantee you 15th to 20th of May to go out and look at your bushes. The worms will be small at that time, but that's when you can intervene. If you wait to the 1st of June, they probably already won the war.
Okay. Betty in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Betty.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have little oval beetles about a quarter inch long that are in the kitchen area that they're black with a wide tan little stripe. Part of their life cycle, I think there's a larva that leaves behind little curly brown crusty skins.
Sure.
I just wondered what they were and how you eradicate them.
Well, it is a special kind of carpet beetle. In fact, probably a better term for this particular one is either the larder beetle, which is the one I think you've got, or some people refer to them as hide beetles. This is the same group of insects that are used to clean skulls in museums. And the secret to their life is that they eat high-protein food sources. So, you know, dried dead mouse carcasses. They will eat dead insects like flies and lady beetles. The name larder beetle comes from they were a pest of dried hams and other things that we have. And so knowing that it's got this specialized food source, to me, the secret is to figure out what are they finding. I do see them in dog food, particularly dog food bags that are forgotten about. It's high moisture, greasy type dog food. A real grain-based dog food would not have a high enough protein content to keep them happy. So to me, the secret here is to try to figure out what the food source is and get that removed, and right there, that should solve the problem.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Betty. Mark in Onalaska, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Yes, hi. I've got a problem with small ants in my dining room. Just outside my dining room, I had it hardscaped, a patio, and there's a flower bed with some wood chips beneath that. We see these small ants most often in the summertime inside of our dining room, actually coming through the wood trim of the molding around the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And when we had that exceptionally wet period back in August and September, I actually noticed a little bit of what I would describe as a slime mold growing both inside and outside of the window frame. That's what kind of alerted me to I've got some kind of probably a water problem here. So I waited until things dried out, and I caulked with silicone on the outside of the window to prevent moisture from getting inside. Now, I took the wood trim off beneath the window, and there was just a small amount of mold on the gypsum board.
Mm-hmm.
But I've let it dry out for about 2 months. Now, there's an electrical outlet there that was just, it looks like it's totally trashed. There was what I guess is described as frass inside that box, just very small particulate matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, do you think there's still an ant problem inside that cavity in the wall there? Am I safe to seal things up on both the inside and the outside, and hopefully nothing's still alive between there?
Yeah, I think you'd continue to see activity and the like, and I'm a little hard pressed what ant species it is, because there's three or four possibilities.
There's occasionally also some black flying ants in this that will emerge with these smaller ants.
Okay, well that just is the reproductives, I don't know if it's cornfield or pavement ants would be my first two choices, although there's still a couple others. I wouldn't worry about sealing things. I guess, if this problem continues for you, what we're going to have to do is bait the ants anyway, and they'll take care of taking the bait back to the nest, and you won't have to have access.
Okay.
And since many ants do like some moisture levels, I think the environmental changes you make are as important as anything we can treat. If this persists, then we're going to play the game of, are these sweet-feeding ants or are these protein-feeding ants? And the simple thing to do in the spring is just to put some honey on a piece of wax paper and some cooking oil and see which one the ants prefer to bother with. That will direct you to the kind of baits that you need. And the baits come in gel forms and little pellets and little containers. That part isn't as important as matching the bait preference to the kind of ants you've got. And then the idea is the workers feed on that, bring it back down to the nest, feed the queen and the rest of the ants. And it really is a good way of treating ants if you have the activity, and I will tell you that the baiting is most effective in the spring anyway.
Okay.
And your idea of caulking itself, honestly, may slow down some of this. Until you told me about the frass in the wall, I was thinking you're just getting some ants migrating in from outside, and then any kind of physical sealing helps a lot in reducing that. But at one time or another, somebody was in that wall. and you wouldn't get that without seeing the frass. And as I said, if it does persist, then I think we can bait them and still get things solved without having to reopen the wall.
Yeah, I tried looking up the definition of frass, and I couldn't find it. Could you give me a definition for that?
Well, it's kind of a generic term to entomologists. It is given to the waste of many insects. When a caterpillar feeds, the things that come out the back end is referred to frass.
Okay.
But it's also this kind of byproduct that you see in ant nests, where it's a combination of wood chips or whatever substrate they're in. The non-digested food particles, including other insect parts that they kick out. So rather than being bodily waste, it's just kind of more of a garbage pile. And the term really is used in both cases.
Yeah, it just looked like fine particulate matter.
And that would be, whatever they're in. If they're a ground nesting species, sometimes we get little, soil particles being pushed into areas. If it's an ant like a carpenter ant that's nesting in styrofoam, I get little, blue or pink chunks of stuff. If it's in wood, it's usually wood fibers. They're much coarser than some of the other insects that we were talking about earlier. There's, almost like small flakes, like somebody's been in there with a little pick or something. But then there's all this other debris mixed with it. And that's why sometimes we ask people when they're finding these things accumulating on their kitchen shelf is send it to us so we can go through and look under the microscope to give us some hint of what kind of critter might be pushing this out.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Diane in Oshkosh has been waiting a little while, so let's go to Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I'm so hoping he can help me today. I teach three-year-old preschool, and we found a praying mantis outside around September 1st.
Okay.
Brought her inside. She laid us two egg sacs before she passed away about 2 weeks ago. Now, what are the chances that these egg sacs are actually fertilized? And I've read that they should hatch between January and April. What kind of condition should I be keeping them in?
I think there's a good chance, from if there's a short time frame from when you found her to when she laid the egg sacs, that she had made it. And that was the big question. What I would do, though, with these, what we call Oetheca technically, they look like a golf ball, but they're kind of spongy. And I would put them in a somewhat cool environment. You can put them out in the garage. If the basement is down around 50 degrees, you're okay. What I would suggest makes the most sense is to let it go through a normal cooling process and then bring them out in the spring and warm up, and then it'll be May before they hatch and you can release them to the outdoors. If they hatch in January, they're cannibalistic. They're going to eat each other and you're going to have a very hard time finding food to keep them fed. And so what's interesting is that the two mantids that we see, the Chinese mantid and the European mantid, neither of them are native. And although people used to buy these Oetheca and bring them in their gardens and have them out in the summer, they would die in the winter. Our winters are just too severe. But we have been convinced now in the last 5 or 6 years that we have breeding populations in the state. And I think this is another artifact of the winters being milder, allowing things to survive here that shouldn't. And so, as I said, it's good that you got these egg cases, and I would let them go through a normal chilling process. You know, you don't want to expose them to the pure cold, but I think in a porch or some other kind of protected environment, they should survive just fine, and then you can let them come out normally. If not, you've got to have fruit flies to feed them when they're young and crickets to feed them when they're bigger. And as I said, it's quite labor-intensive and difficult, and the biggest problem is they eat each other too, so you'd rather not have that happen.
Okay, so what do you think if I put them in a garage? Is that too cold, or a basement that's,
No, I don't think a garage is too cold. Put them in a jar or something, so they're a little bit sheltered there, and then the combination, I think that should be perfect.
All righty, well, thanks a lot. It's been a great experience for us to watch them.
Thank you. I bet it has been fun. Thanks, Diane. Fred in New Berlin will turn to you. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I got a little different question. We hear about all the insects that we import into the country that do damage, beetles and all this stuff. Do we export anything that causes a lot of damage?
Yes. The people in Europe are not real happy about our Colorado potato beetle, which we're not happy either because it's hard to control. And, you find that countries, if you look historically who their trade partners are, is unfortunately they send both plant diseases and insects along with it. And, right now, our biggest fights have been more with Asian imports in the last 20 years. And, whether we talk the problems with the emerald ash borer or Asian longhorn beetle, it's probably one of the more frustrating things that I've seen in my career, these continued immigration of critters, and we really pay for it. And but, yes, we do.
We do our share of exporting, too.
Right. In the countries, the requirements now for shipping lumber and other things out of this country have continued to tighten up because they don't want us to spread oak wilt there and those kind of things. So there are restrictions that people that export things here have to follow, much like people in China have to do certain things, hopefully, so that we don't inherit some of their problems.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Fred. Marilyn in Cleveland, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. I have another moth question. We have a cedar chest that belonged to my husband's grandmother, and I always stored our woolen things in it. And to my dismay, one fall I opened it, and our sweaters, everything was just riddled and ruined. I had to throw the whole lot out. And since then, I've put woolen things in there with mothballs, and they have survived. But I can't get the mothball smell out in the winter, and I walk around smelling like mothballs.
Sure.
So well, I'd like to know if there's anything I can do with that cedar chest.
Yeah, the cedar is extremely effective for about 12 months. And it's interesting. It's a repellent, not a killer. So what I'm telling you is if you had a brand-new cedar chest and you put a sweater in that had moths in it, they would still eat your sweater. And after 12 months, the level of cedar oils drop to that, even loses that effect. And so it's kind of a false sense of security. You know, and the mothballs, if the concentrations are heavy enough, you are fumigating is what you're doing. And I don't like the idea of people breathing too much mothballs because it's not the best for us either. And so what you may consider, and I don't know if this will fit with your clothing or not, but I think the better way to go about things is to put things away clean and put them away in Tupperware or other substantial containers that have good fitting lids. So a clean article in a container like that will not get moths.
Okay.
And then you don't have to worry about the mothball smells or what's going on with that. I just think it's a better way. And we don't see a lot of damage in the winter when we're wearing the articles because, you know, as I had mentioned earlier, clothes moths don't like to be out in the open in the sun. They like to be in undisturbed, dark places left alone. And so most of the damage we see is in the summer.
So it wouldn't do any good to put cedar oil on the cedar chest?
Then you're going back to what new cedar is like, and so it will help somewhat in repellency. So again, if there are no moths to begin with and the oil levels are very high, you will get a positive effect out of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fine.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we have Bob in Minneapolis, Minnesota next. Bob, hi.
Hi. It's actually Leopolis, Wisconsin.
Oh, Leopolis, Wisconsin. Okay.
Yeah, my question is about an interesting bug that we caught this summer, and we found it on the internet called a hag moth. Are they common around here? What do they do? What's their
purpose? Did you find the caterpillar or did you find the moth?
It was a caterpillar.
Yeah. They're relatively common. I it's one of those things, if you told me to go find one, it might take me the whole summer, so I'm not going to say that they're, you know, you see them in every tree. I quite commonly see them on maple. It's an interesting one because another name for the caterpillar is the monkey slug. And it doesn't look like a caterpillar. As you know, it's got these funny little brown arms that are all fuzzy. And some people thought that these would cause skin irritations because we do have some caterpillars that cause skin irritations. But interesting enough, the hag moth got blamed for something it can't do. But if you touch them, these flanges are almost like small octopus arms will fall off. I mean, it's kind of a crazy looking thing. And the moth itself is interesting. I mean, you know, so many of our moths in the state are just browns and grays, and unless you're really crazy about collecting them, they're kind of boring. But this one is an interesting moth, and not overly colorful, but again, is more colorful than the average moth that we've got.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Bob, for calling. And let's go to Ed in Wausau. Ed, hi to you.
Hi, thank you for the program. I got a heck of a deal on a 20-pound bag of sunflower seeds that I was going to feed to cardinals. And when I slit the top, I would always seal it, you know, with like a mini clip. You know, not a perfect seal, but I found these little grubworms coming out about a 16th of an inch, and then they'd kind of climb up the wall and turn into like a triangle-shaped half-inch or less than a half-inch flying thing.
Yeah.
My question is, when you're to get rid of them, when it gets down, I've got everything sealed up with Scotch tape now, and what they're in is fairly heavy. It's heavy paper and plastic. I didn't see any place where they're chewing through. But just subjecting them to like some 20 below weather, you know, when it gets really cold, would that get rid of them? Or should I just plant the sunflower seeds?
No, well, I think two things. If you're going to plan to feed all these sunflowers this winter, you're in good shape. Nothing's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I would say keep the stuff stored out where it's cool in the garage so they can't develop. The biggest concern, it sounds like you've got Indian meal moth, which is a common problem in birdseed and various pet food, is if the moths find your way in your kitchen, then potentially your noodles and your rice and a lot of things in the kitchen can become infested. And so that's, you know, it's just a bother. And so as far as the birds are concerned, you've honestly concentrated the protein because when they get into the grubs or find some adults in some of those sunflowers that you're feeding, that's not going to hurt them of anything. Again, you can argue it's even nutritionally better. So I would just keep it someplace cool, use it up, make sure that you're done with it by next spring so that when things do warm up that they don't come through and you'll be just fine.
All right. Thanks, Ed. Dave in Dresser, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Phil, I had a thought for the lady that has the chair with the powder beetles in it.
Okay.
Could she wrap that up in plastic, bring that into her home now, and keep it warm for a couple months until we get that bitterly cold weather we do each winter, and then take it outside and shock those beetles?
She could if we get cold enough. And you know, that's the tough thing to predict on it. What we find is that, as we have talked about, the shock kills them. A big object doesn't cool down as fast. And we have the same problem when we take these things into walk-in freezers, that if, you know, you got something that's, you know, the size of a softball, it's pretty easy to kill things. If I got something the size of a chair, I get nervous because I know that center of the chair isn't going to cool as fast. But we've had success with antique pieces doing exactly what you said, is keeping them warm, keeping the insects active. And then when we finally, if we do get the 10 below 2 days that we see, we could do it.
And thanks very much for calling, Dave. Good idea. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking the world of insects now with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison campus. I'm Larry Mueller, pleased to have you listening in. If you have a question about an insect, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And some callers online, so we'll go right to the phones. And Jeremy in Onalaska, thanks for calling. Hi. Jeremy, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
I got a question. I got a couple ball pythons, and one of them I think he has mites, and seen a little thing run across his face. And I want to know how dangerous that is for me and my family, and if it's something that I should get taken care of, like, right away.
Well, a couple things. I do know there are some mites associated with snakes and under their skin, so it's kind of a parasite of them, but is not something that we'd expect problems with people. The other thing is that there are other mites sometimes associated with the bedding that are not parasitic at all, and so it's kind of hard to say which of the two that you've got. If the animal's starting to show either some distress or some discoloration, then I think you should talk with the vet, because that's a little out of my area of expertise. But again, I can assure you that the mites associated with snakes are not things that we have to worry about as being people parasites.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeremy. Christine and Dousman, your turn now. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Well, I have in the last week or so, my husband and son have both broken out in what looks like little small mosquito bites all over their ankles and wrists and hands. And we're wondering what that could possibly be this time of year when it's not everyone. Seems like we've combed everywhere and we have not seen anything that looks like a flea or anything like that. The one thing they did just do recently was clean out an old barn attic. And is there some kind of insect that could have been living up there that got them?
Well, I mean, you always worry about mites, both associated with birds, and there is something called a straw itch mite, which is a parasite of grain insects in particular, and those would cause those kind of bites. And it's almost like chiggers in the sense that sometimes your reaction is delayed for a few hours.
Okay.
So that could be, but I would not expect things to be on their person. And the big question would be is, are they continuing to get new bites per se or not? If not, then it doesn't fit. But that would be the kind of scenario that you could run into either the bird mites or these straw itch mites.
And that would be something that could live like in an attic that hadn't been used for a while?
Yes. Especially, well, you know, again, if you got birds nesting on the structure. The straw itch mite would be more, as I said, where you have to have animal feed or some source of grain insects because without the grain insects, you don't have the itch mites.
Yeah, there wouldn't be any grain up there. It would probably be more likely to be birds. Okay. Is that something that should be treated, or will it just go away when they're...
Well, typically, you know, I see more of the complaints in June. In what I equate it to is when the young birds are leaving the nest, that the mites would much rather feed on the birds than people.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually when the birds are removed from the environment, the mites go in pretty short order.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Yep, thanks, Christine. Brittany in La Crosse, hello to you.
Hi. I had a question. Down in the basement in the laundry room above a drain is this huge black spider. It's about the size of a palm, and the body's part is about a quarter. And it doesn't have a web, and it seems like it just like there's dead insects around, so it must just kind of prey on them. It doesn't have a web or anything. And when I come down, it goes down in the drain, so it's not aggressive at all.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably a form of wolf spider. There's even some ground-dwelling forms, and that would be my first guess. Mm-hmm. It's a little weird because they are nighttime hunting spiders, and although we do get them wandering indoors quite a bit, usually they don't stay indoors. They usually, eventually wander out. Nothing particularly dangerous about them, but they're big and ugly looking, which tends to get people's concerns. One would also think that, food's going to become in short supply, and if they were outdoors and normally cooled down so they'd go dormant, they were okay. But being in the basement may be a mistake on its part because it's still going to need its energy, but it's not going to have much to eat. So, as long as you're comfortable with the spider being present, I mean, I don't think there's any reason that you necessarily have to kill it. And again, you may just find one day it just kind of disappears.
Okay, so it'll go out on its own. I don't have to touch it.
Right.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Brittany. Kathy and Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, this past summer, I have a sunroom on my house, and I had yellow jackets in the wall of one of the sunroom, and they were coming and going from the outside electrical outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Which evidently wasn't sealed very well. And they actually drilled a hole to the inside, and we're starting to come into the sunroom. And we patched that up, and I took out an inside outlet, and there was dead bees clogged all the way around there. Now I'm wondering do I have to take off that outside outlet to clean all that out? Is there a queen in there or anything I have to worry about?
No, the colony itself has died probably as of about the 1st of November, if not earlier. The original queen has also died. The new queens have left the nest and are out hiding under rocks or some other environment. They had to both find a mate, and after mating, then they hibernate. And then in the spring, they start everything from scratch, and they do not come back to the old nest.
Good.
And also the dead bodies that are in there, they're so dry. There's no odor about them. There's no problem. So those don't have to be removed. The only thing that I would look for is that little opening that they created, make sure that it's sealed up by, the 1st of June, just in the rare chance that another queen would be flying by or a bumblebee does the same thing and utilize that kind of environment. So as long as things are sealed up, there's no reason to worry about anything else.
Okay, so just seal it up around that outside outlet.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, great.
All right, Kathy, thanks a lot for calling. Relief on her voice there. Nancy in Minneapolis, I believe. She's on the road, so she's got a question for us. Hi, Nancy.
Right. Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have these little tiny black or dark brown little beetles. They look like little tiny circles, and they almost look like they have a little line crease in the middle, and they fly. And in the they're not there right now, but I would say, at least in the warmer weather, they come back every year, and they're in my cupboards and in my drawers. I find them dead everywhere. It's just prolific, and I don't know what they are.
Well, I'm guessing because there's lots of things that would fit that description, but they sound like carpet beetle adults to me. And carpet beetles feed on everything from animal hair to feathers to dead insects to grain-based products. And because this on-again, off-again, it sounds like that the food source is someplace that gets cold enough in the winter that they can't breed or move in. But it could be anything. It could be old decon mouse bait, which is grain-based. So that's something to keep your eyes open on while you're cleaning and stuff. If you've got any beetles around, I'd be more than happy if you send me either a digital picture or a critter just to confirm that's what it is. But that part fits that, they'd wander around. They're relatively long-lived, and there's so many things they can come from. And everybody's got a couple in the house. That doesn't concern me. But when you find them as common as you do, there's a hot spot. There's some kind of major source that has to be dealt with.
Okay. And they're really small, almost like the size of a pinhead.
Seems a little small, but there's a number of species of carpet beetles. I think ultimately I'd feel more comfortable if you sent me something just to be sure, because with, depending who you talk to, 18 to 28,000 different insects in this state, I mean, there's lots of things that are small black critters, but being in the house kind of restricts it a bit. So as I said, I'm very suspicious it's food-based in one form or another. But just to be sure, if you can find even dead ones, I don't need to see live ones, send them over to me.
Okay, I'll do that. And then to get rid of them, just...
Well, it's usually a source. If you find the food source and clean it up, that's the solution. And why I'm not big on spraying for this kind of stuff is I tell people, you know, if you got a bad box of Bisquick, you can spray all you want and you still got bugs if you don't throw the Bisquick out type mm-hmm. of thing. So it's one of these things. I think it's better to know what you got and what you got to look for. And then once you clean it up and make sure they don't do an end run, that's the biggest problem with a lot of these food pests, that they start in a bag of noodles, and by the time you catch it, they got into the Hershey bars and all this other stuff. And so a lot of people have gone to putting things in containers that are substantial, you know, snap top, you know, Tupperware, glass jars, those kind of things, because then the insects can't get into that kind of container. And if you miss something, they are contained. They can't escape and infest other things.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Nancy, for calling. And let's go to Jan in Wisconsin Rapids next. Hi, Jan.
Hi there. Say, I thought I'd tell you, we shop for pecans. We eat a lot of pecans, and we're always looking for fresher ones. So I've been going to stores other than the grocery stores to get them, and we found one bag full of bugs, and the bag actually had a lot of like sand on the bottom of it where they had been eating the pecans. Mm-hmm. So people might want to watch that over the holidays, what they buy. Take a look at it before they put it in their cart.
Well, you know, and we see this with a lot of stuff, but I will tell you, I see even roasted nuts have grubs in them at times. I see this quality control stuff, so we won't go into it because we don't want to ruin people's Thanksgiving. But you do have to be careful. And anytime you see dust and debris in the bag, be suspicious. It may be infested with something. And the good news is there's no health issues with this. But the bad news is some of these things can spread to other food products. And even without that, again, you've paid good money for something, and unfortunately, you may have to throw it out.
Well, it fattened up a squirrel for me.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, Jan. Thanks for calling. Frank in Port Edwards, it's your turn. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Phil, I believe it's the last time you're on. I reported seeing a big ant carrying a little ant by the chops, releasing the little ant, which ran around in circles and then came right back to the big ant, and off they went again for a few feet. Do you remember that tale?
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
To be honest, I never did talk to Bob about it, so I'm remiss at that. But
okay, maybe next time.
Well, that's when you have to remember for
next time. Yes, I'll have to get a hold of Dr. Gene and just see if he's got, as I said, because he would be the person in our department that would understand that.
We'll try and get that for you next month, Frank. Sarah in Delafield, hi to you.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions for you. The first one relates to we had a few white oaks along our road that were dying and or almost dead. We were allowed to take them down for firewood, and in cutting up and splitting that firewood this past weekend, we were finding numerous little quarter-inch to half-inch white grub-like borers, fairly flat, not really round, with a pretty distinct head on them. So, I was wondering, are those borers coming in as a secondary thing because the wood was already dead, or could they be killing the white oak? Because I'm seeing numerous white oaks through Waukesha County that are turning chlorotic and then dying. So
well,
I'm curious about that.
Yeah, my biggest concern in what I'm seeing in the lab, although, you know, dead trees get all kinds of beetles in it, oak in particular has an insect called the two-line chestnut borer that attacks stress trees. And we have had enough drought stress in this state in the last 4 years that a lot of old, undisturbed trees that should be doing just fine are dying, and what we're finding is it's the chestnut borer that's responsible. Now, this insect is closely related to the emerald ash borer that we've talked about before on the ash. It leaves a very characteristic wormy S-shaped trail underneath the bark. The larvae are, they don't get much more than about 3/4 of an inch in size, are relatively skinny. But even if what you have got is secondary, if you were to ask for my opinion in Waukesha County, what's killing the oaks, it's chestnut borer.
Mm.
And in, you know, we had this very heavy rain and we were all happy to see that. But to be honest, this last month or 6 weeks has been very dry. And so I don't think we have technically broken the drought for some of these trees yet. And I'm still concerned that if we don't get a good growing season in the spring, good moisture levels, and get these trees, because the bottom line is a strong, healthy tree can fend its way and fight these things off. But when they're so stressed out from drought, this is the insect that takes them out. And
right.
As I said, it is definitely in the diagnostic lab. the culprit in killing oaks, and whether they're sent in for oak wilt samples. And my colleague Brian, if he can't find them, he brings them up to me, and about 80% of the time I can find chestnut borers in these trees.
Okay. And the second question is house-related regarding fruit flies and getting rid of them.
Well, you know, this is the time of the year I get the calls. What I tell people is, these fruit flies can't be coming in from outside. They have to be breeding internally. You need a source of moisture. You need a source of organic matter. And it has to be decaying, because what fruit flies breed on, the maggots feed on the yeast that's associated with the breakdown. So I worry about bad pumpkins and squashes right now, bad onions, bad potatoes. Recycling cans can get enough sugar-based syrup that starts to ferment. That it is where it can come from. You know, normally the kind of fruit that you have out on the kitchen table is not ripe enough, is not decayed enough. It may attract the adult flies, but that's not the source. And although you can bring a couple home from the grocery store, as I said, when you get this ongoing problem, there is a, quote, hot spot somewhere. We've seen them in sour mops, in rags that are used to clean up things like orange juice. If you don't rinse it out, that can get kind of slimy, and that slime layer is enough yeast associated with it that they can breed on that. So, again, organic matter, moisture. If things were dry, they can't breed. And something decaying, we call them vinegar flies because that's the kind of odor you often associate, the acetic acid odor when things are fermenting, not necessarily totally rotten, but starting to break down. And, the life cycle's quick. It can go from egg to adult in 8 or 9 days.
So if you get rid of the hot spot, how long can you expect to get rid of the problem?
Life should be very good within 2 days. If you've not seen a reduction in the fly numbers in 2 days, there's still more going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too, if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Margo in Glendale, it's your turn now. Hi, Margo.
Hi. I've got a problem with some little tiny black ants that have no apparent nest on the surface. But when I dig in the area, they come out and they bite.
Okay. Those are probably field ants.
Field ants?
Because they are notorious for that. They bite, and then if they get the opportunity, they turn and inject, or not inject, but spray formic acid on the bite. And you can imagine that makes it burn even worse. They're really beneficial most of the time because they go other insects and problems there. They just don't like their nest disturbed. So this is the one we don't want to put a picnic basket on top of their colony, because it'll ruin the picnic pretty quick. Boy, as far as treating them...
Well, I don't want to treat them. I just wanted to know what they were.
Yeah, the genus is Formica, F-O-R-M-I-C-A, and there's a number of species, but we call them field ants as a group, and some of them make great big mounds. They're interesting. There's even one that's been from Europe that's been found in Maine now that's a real stinker. We're having trouble with people getting bites, so it's kind of like a northern fire ant is what they refer it to. We have not seen that species in Wisconsin and hope not to for the near future. So,
yeah, well, they don't leave anything on the surface. There's no way of knowing that they're there, and then I start digging, and pretty soon I'm feeling all these critters crawling on me, biting.
And basically what they're doing is trying to defend the nest.
Yes, I know. Okay.
Thanks, Margo. Thanks a lot for calling. Ron in Waupaca, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for the call, getting to me, and appreciate the program.
Sure.
Question about ticks, and I've had an ongoing battle with my wife and even people in the natural resources about the location of ticks. Everything I've read says they're usually in the tall grass, and other people I've talked to say no, they're falling from the trees. So, what's the answer there?
Well, if you look at what a tick's about, we had mentioned earlier, a tick only eats 3 times in its life, and what it has to do is sit and wait for something to come by that it can eat. And it's interesting; it's usually in tall objects like grass, and as you walk by When I was a student, we used to blow on them, and the carbon dioxide of your breath gets them real excited, and they start flailing their little arms around. I mean, they can't see. Ticks don't have functional eyes, and so they basically are relying on their senses. And then what they do is latch on. And I think where this concern that they're falling out of the trees comes from, that most of us, when we're out in the woods, have pants and socks on. And so when a tick gets on you, it will crawl. In the first place it's probably going to find skin is around your neck. And so people get this impression that they're very high up and falling down. Now, I will tell you, I've been in a couple situations where I know they have fallen out of a bush or something close by.
Yeah.
Kind of jumped on me. But generally, I expect to find them in tall, long grass, in brushy areas. And if you get into a mowed situation, you know, I don't care how many trees are around, you don't see ticks because there isn't that kind of environment to hold them.
Oh, okay. That's a reasonable answer. Another question I have, too, is about the chestnut borer you just were talking about.
Yeah.
I have 20 acres here, and I do have a tree that is stressed and had people from DNR diagnose it. And the problem from this point is what do you do to make sure that doesn't spread?
Well, a couple things. You know, we have no control over the weather. You know, we see a lot of chestnut borers attacking trees that have been hurt from construction damage. And so we talk a lot about when people are building to really respect that oak trees will not tolerate disturbance, because even without a drought stress, the construction damage is enough to allow the chestnut borer to get in. So anything you can do for your tree's health in the long run. It was a very valuable tree in your front yard. There are some insecticides that could be applied, but this is not practical for the woodlot situation. What I would tell you is if you lose the tree, is you can cut it up for firewood, but next spring I would tarp the firewood so that you basically cook the borers out so they can't develop. If you don't do that, then you're basically providing an insect nursery, because the insects will still develop in that dead tree. So you stack the firewood and you leave it there. You don't clean it up and you don't tarp it. That would cause problems. So that would be the one thing. If you cut it, tarp it. And other than that, anything you can do to help the trees along as far as, you know, so being careful about cutting roots, you know, putting additional soil on, those kind of things. And again, let's hope we get a break in this weather, because chestnut borer is a native insect and it does go on again and off again like a light depending on the weather conditions. But as I said, from my perspective, we have been in drought situations really the last four summers at one time or another. And even with this heavy rain in the southern part of the state, you know, it really didn't, it wasn't enough for a long enough time to get us to turn the corner, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Thanks for calling. And Jim in Waukesha, hello to you.
I'm good. How are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, I was wondering about common house centipedes. We've seen a few around our house, a couple big ones, but not anything real bad. But I don't know enough about them to know whether we should aggressively pursue it or just let them go because they eat spiders.
Well, you know, they freak people out because they're got long legs and they scurry so quick, and they do get upwards of about 3 inches long. They are not native to Wisconsin. They are basically a tropical species, but the environment we produce indoors, they like. They are very slow to breed, and because they eat insects and spiders, as you say, there's not much for them to eat, so I never see them really explode in a house. You know, it's one in the bathroom sink every 2 months type of thing, and so I don't really get that concerned about them. It is true that if you handled one, they could bite, but I dare you to catch one. Mm-hmm. They're quick enough that, you know, we just don't see that, and they're not going to run across the living room to come and bite you in the toe. That's not, you know, as you know.
They just don't do that.
They're the other way. They any kind of disturbance, they're often running and trying to hide. So, but for people who must do something, you can use these glue board traps, which are basically sticky cardboard, and one crawls across it, it will catch it. So that's kind of a passive trap. And they would respond to various insecticides if somebody had to. But don't spray the basement floor. You know, they like it where it's damp, so they often see them in the basement. But concrete is the worst thing in the world to spray. It doesn't work.
And thank you very much for calling. And Phil, thank you so much.
Nice to be here, Larry.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, sir.
And happy Thanksgiving to you. I'll be back tomorrow and our annual Thanksgiving Day get-together with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. We'll be talking about birds, the birds of Wisconsin and elsewhere. So really looking forward to having those guys back, and they always seem to enjoy it too, and I think you do too. So I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. But stay with us now. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.